You know, you can see there are many things going on and many changes taking place, and things will catch your eye. And I've talked to more than one person who's very scientific, and you have like a certain mindset. It almost seems like a certain wave of thought that people are in, whether they're artistic, whether scientific, or whatever. My guest this week, Dr. Rick Sheff, he calls himself, I guess, a former atheist. He wrote a book, Joyfully Shattered, A Physician's Awakening to the Crossroads of Science and Spirituality. And he's had many adventures, and he's had many things that have snapped him and made him look at things in a different direction. So welcome to the show, Dr. Sheff.
Thank you very much, TJ. Pleasure to be here.
Now tell me a little bit about this book, Joyfully Shattered. How do you come up with something that says Joyfully Shattered?
Well, that's because I am joyfully shattered, but that kind of needs some explanation. So I was raised in a family I describe as passionately atheist.
Okay.
Recently visiting my father, who's 90 years old, and I said that to him, and he piped up, absolutely, still am.
Oh, really?
So that is the family I come from. And I knew atheism to be the truth with great certainty into my 20s. And then I've had a series of experiences since then that over the last 40 years that have taught me the world is not as I learned at my parents' knee or in my science classes. It is a far more wondrous and mysterious world that we live in. And I think the way to understand the title is part of my background is I had the chance to study philosophy at Oxford. And while I was there, I came across the work of a Harvard philosopher known as William Van Orman Quine, and he coined a phrase, the web of belief. And he said, every one of us lives within and functions within a personal web of belief. Think of this as a network of mutually reinforcing knowledge claims about the world. The desk in front of me is solid. If I hit it with my head, it will hurt. I also think most of the empty space because it's made up of atoms and elementary particles. I may have religious beliefs, I may have moral beliefs, I may have beliefs about history, everything I take to be true. And the question is, what happens when you encounter something that doesn't fit your personal web of belief? Now, we really have three choices, and this is really how we're wired biologically and psychologically. One is that we can say, oh, that's not data. That's not relevant. That's coincidence. It's a measurement problem. And it doesn't have to impact our web of belief. And this is what we do a lot because people use their web of belief in a way that reinforces. They see things that reinforce their web of belief, and they won't even see things that are not consistent with it.
Right, yeah.
Others will say, well, yeah, it's data, but it's not going to impact my web in a significant way. It's going to hang out on the periphery. It's sort of an aberrant measurement or data point or experience that I can't quite explain away, but it's not going to impact my web. And then you can have experiences that go deeper. And this has been my journey, that have become more and more powerful experiences that I can no longer deny, that have migrated closer and closer to the core of my web of belief, causing it to gradually shift over time and eventually to shatter.
That's quite a move. That's quite a change.
And the result has been more joy than I ever expected.
Wow. That's exactly the way I feel. I didn't grow up as an atheist. I grew up as a Lutheran, which some people could say was just as bad. I'm kidding. And, you know, because religion can kind of make you look at things in a certain way. And there's a difference between religion and spirituality. But along the way, I've had all these spiritual moments, and I mean incredible ones that the average person probably doesn't have. Hopefully they do. But I've felt the love from the other side, what I believe is the love that exists, if you want to call it from divine spirit, God. I felt it from both of my parents when they came back after they passed. And that love is the love that people speak of when they have a near-death experience. It is so powerful, so joyful. That's why I liked your title, Joyfully Shattered, because to me, this love, The best way I can describe it, Dr. Chef, is just pure joy. It's just, you feel so good in it, don't you?
Yeah. And that's what spirituality is, inherently an individual subjective experience. And I think that's the path we're all here to follow, to open ourselves to that experience in whatever form it takes. And it can take many, many different forms. And one of the reasons I wrote the book, it's filled with stories. And the stories are all true. And I've written it really as breadcrumbs on my path, because I've traversed a path I never expected to do. And I think by writing the stories and sharing them, it helps others. People who've read the book, and it's getting really, really wonderful responses. People, they laugh with the stories, they cry with the stories, but the most common feedback I get is they are inspired by the stories, by the whole, and it inspires them for their own journey.
Right. That's the best thing I think you can do, is to share something that people... You know, you can't change anybody by what you say, or nor should we. I don't believe we should, Dr. Chef, try to change another person's beliefs or thoughts. But the life you lead and maybe the stories you tell can be an inspiration so that others can move forward.
Well, that's my hope. And I also have a website if people are interested.
Yeah, what is that?
The website is www.rickchefmd.com, okay. And it's RICK. SHEFFMD.com. No C. I told my wife when she married me, I said, you're going to spend the rest of your life saying that's Chef, SHEFF, no C. And she told me that would be the case. And I put a bunch of free downloads there so that people can have access to this. I've been writing a blog that's really, the title of it is Dr. Rick's Wondrous World. And it's my exploration of all these questions. I'm a scientist. I'm a skeptic. I'm a physician. I have a very conventional day job. I work with hospitals and healthcare systems across the country trying to help heal healthcare and those who work within it. And at the same time, I've had this amazing journey, and so I want to really share that with people. And the blog, I just started a series of blog entries on spirituality and terrorism. And the subtitle to that series is The Triumph of Love Over Fear.
That's good. That sounds very good. So what are these things that you, it says that you've had very unusual experiences that you've encountered that have shifted you. Can you tell us about maybe a couple of those things that you've experienced that were just something that was like a huge aha moment?
Sure, happy to share some of them. The book is filled with these stories and experiences. So one of the earlier ones happened when my first wife, her name is Marcia, and she was pregnant with our first child, and she had a very dear friend, Susan, who was also pregnant about 2 months further along than Marcia. And Susan goes past her due date and gets kind of depressed about it, and I had watched Susan and Marcia have a connection during this pregnancy time that I could not explain. And I was a family physician, am a family physician. I was delivering babies the first part of my practice, so I watched a lot of it. I didn't understand what was going on between the two of them, but it was very intense. And then one morning, Marcia sits bolt upright next to me at 4:30 in the morning saying, Rick, wake up. Susan is in labor. What? No, I know. Susan is in labor. I was awakened, this energy coursing through my body. Susan is in labor. I said, okay, call her. I can't. It's 4:30 in the morning. So she had trouble getting back to sleep. The next morning she gets up. Should I call Susan? Should I not? The phone rings. It's Susan saying, guess what? I'm in labor. And Marcia responds, I know. It turns out, awakened by her first contraction at 4:30 in the morning.
Wow.
Susan didn't know she was in labor until 5 a.m. Marcia knew at 4:30. Now, I'm a scientist. I'm a skeptic. I didn't dream this. The two of us had that same experience. That's a data point.
Yeah.
I don't need a K case-controlled prospective series, you know, trial to teach me that we communicate at a distance. Susan was 5 miles away, and we communicate in our sleep. I have an incontrovertible data point. Now, that was early on, and I've had many, many experiences that go much further than that that I share in the book. But, you know, the fascinating thing is the next couple of days, I'm so excited about this, I share this with a fellow physician, and you know what his response was? Coincidence. I went, what? Coincidence? Oh, yes. I believe in Occam's razor, and I write about this in the book, which is the principle that says when there are multiple explanations, the simplest one is the one you adopt. And he said, I prefer to adopt the interpretation that this is coincidence rather than postulate that we communicate at a distance telepathically. And I'm going, but that's not science. And I actually came across a wonderful term for this. I talk about it in the book, and the term is scientism. Scientism is the use of the trappings of science in defense of dogma.
So they're always going to
revert. That's exactly what my friend was doing.
They're always going to revert back to it because, really, I would say, from my perspective, is that they're just closed off to the potential of something else, that it can all be explained away in their, like you said, their web of belief.
And they're more attached to their web of belief than to the truth. That's not good science. That's not high integrity. But we see it all the time. First of all, we're wired that way as human beings to not give up our web of belief too easily. We need it to function in the world. It was probably in evolution. It probably served a very functional purpose in survival. But also, let me bring in the work of a man named Thomas Kuhn, who wrote a book called The Structure of Scientific Revolutions. And he said, it's part of the history of we'll call it the philosophy of science. We're trying to understand, as a society, we believe very deeply that knowing something scientifically is somehow better or more true than knowing something any other way. And the question is, why is that the case? And philosophers have been wrestling with this in the philosophy of science for a long time. And I can tell you, nobody has really satisfactorily answered that question. And Kuhn's response was, instead of arguing about this as philosophers, let's look at what scientists actually do. So he did a study of the history of science, and he came up with a really interesting recognition. He said, this thing we call science, it's actually two very distinctly different types of activities. One he calls normal science, and Kuhn is the one who gave us the term paradigm in the way we use it now, in paradigm shifts. So he said normal science is what scientists are doing when there is a dominant paradigm that those working in that particular field all agree is the paradigm. It's their web of belief. It's another way to talk about the web of belief. And in that setting, they use the paradigm to make predictions, test the predictions, and modify the paradigm a little bit or confirm it, but they're all working in the same paradigm. That is normal science, happens most of the time, but then in a particular discipline, we begin to accumulate what he calls, and I now call, data points, data that doesn't fit the dominant paradigm. And because science is an inherently conservative activity, and people are very attached to the dominant paradigm, we explain the way the data points, we justify it, we rationalize it, but we don't change the paradigm. But when enough of these data points accumulate, then we enter a period of what Kuhn calls revolutionary science. And during that time, the very act of doing science is casting about for what the new paradigm might be, proposing, testing what the new paradigm might be. And the example he gives is we had the Earth at the center of the universe under the Aristotelian paradigm, and there were some measurement problems that they were having to explain, the revolution of the planets, etc. And so eventually Copernicus says, well, what if we put the sun at the center And it started to make more sense, but it was not well received. Trust me, they didn't want to change that paradigm.
Yeah.
But we entered a period of revolutionary science that lasted about 200 years until Newton put it all together with calculus and gravity, and we entered the Newtonian paradigm, and we entered another period of normal science. And that gave us the Industrial Revolution and so many other things. And then late in the 19th century, we began to encounter some other data points, aberrancies in the orbit of Mercury, some challenges when they tried to measure the speed of light. And Einstein then said, well, what if the speed of light is constant from any reference frame? What would that look like? And that gave us initially the theory of special relativity and then general relativity. And we discovered that time and space themselves are not as we thought they were. And then we add to that quantum mechanics, and that's today's dominant paradigm in physics. But does anybody think that's the final paradigm, that's the truth? And the answer is no. That's just today's paradigm. And now I'm excited because I'm finding both not only my journey, but when I read and study the work of others, there are scientists on the cutting edge of many different fields who are coming to the same conclusion, that what today we call spiritual actually is not only consistent with science, but science done well is increasingly proving the truth of what we call spiritual.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why the coming new paradigm is a paradigm that will integrate science and spirituality, both done well. And that's a very exciting time we're in. And that's why the title of the book is Joyfully Shattered, A Physician's Awakening at the Crossroads of Science and Spirituality.
Well, how did, since you come from a long line of atheists, as you said, how did they take it when you started to see things a little differently?
Well, I'll put it to you this way. My father was asking me about some information about my most recent trip to John of God, and I was sharing it with him. And also, I have to tell you, my younger brother is also a physician. My older brother is a physician. So there are three physicians in the family. And he was listening to this, and he finally turned to my mother and said, Janet, where did we go wrong?
Oh, he really messed up. So you mentioned John of God. What is your experience with John of God?
So I have been to Brazil to see John of God 8 different times, and I have seen him in the United States and Canada 8 different times. So I have a lot of experience with John of God, and I write about that. There's a whole chapter in the book about my experiences with John of God. And these are truly mind-blowing. I witness things there I cannot explain. My wife has been healed from a number of different conditions, but one of which is reflex sympathetic dystrophy, which for anyone who's had reflex sympathetic dystrophy, it's also known as complex regional pain syndrome. It is a condition that happens after trauma. In her case, it happened after a very routine arthroscopic procedure to repair a cartilage tear in her knee. And it's a chronic pain condition that is a feed forward, that you live in chronic, terrible pain. And she had gotten this and had battled it back to something she could live with, but it was still ongoing. And she went down there, and she came back in complete remission.
Gone. Can you describe what she went through for people that are listening? I mean, is that something you don't mind getting into?
So we're going to talk about John of God. I think it's very important to understand this, that I can't explain what he does. I can tell you their understanding of what he does and why it works. And I'm not here to say it's the truth or not, but their understanding is in the context of Spiritism. And in the beliefs of Spiritism, they believe there are spirits, souls, that can either be in a body or not in a body. That's part of reincarnation, and that's part of their web of belief. And the man Joao to share the Faria. He never called himself John of God. He was called that by somebody else, and that name stuck. He is what's understood to be what's known as a medium. And in that environment, a medium is someone who can allow a spirit that's not in a body to work through them. And that is how the healing occurs. And so this man, basically, he's considered a full trance medium, which means he gives over his whole body and his consciousness, and some other spirit comes in, and that is who or what is doing the healing. So that in of itself is quite a stretch for someone's web of belief right there. And yet, healings happen there, and I don't want to spend a lot of time, because there's a lot to explain about what happened there. But there are people sitting in what's called current, which is holding meditation, prayer, awareness of love, of, you know, that kind of energy and consciousness that really creates the environment in which this work is being done. So I've had amazing experiences just sitting in current, and I describe those in the book, that just have taken me to places I had no idea I could go to. And it's about opening to love. And that's the other thing about John of God. People go there for healing, and one of the things that is said is, do your work. If you want to be healed, do your work. And first of all, John of God is very clear, and the guidelines, it's called the Casa de Don Ignacio, the House of St. Ignatius, the rules are very clear. Follow what your doctors tell you. They support conventional medicine. This is not a replacement for it. They say that over and over again, and I agree with them. Secondly, it's about doing your work, that if you want to receive healing, your work is to open your heart to love. Mm-hmm. And that's a beautiful message, and it's very much what John of God and the Casa are about.
You know, as you're telling that story, and a thought hit me, and I'm just going to throw this out there, because I truly believe he does call on other physicians that have lived before to help him with these surgeries, these, if you want to call them, psychic surgeries. But I was going to ask you, as a physician, have you ever worked on somebody and felt like something else was working through you?
I would say that the experience I would describe is more, and it's happened more in this phase of my work than I think I was aware of when I was younger, because I also was not as in touch with this or aware of it. I practiced clinical medicine for the first part of my practice as a family doctor. And actually, the book opens with a story like that, a true story about a young six-year-old boy who I delivered and cared for the first 6 months of his life, and then he came down with a terrible infection of meningococcemia, which is life-threatening. And I tell that story, and eventually I have this moment where it's time for him to die. Mm. I'm there to help his parents with his dying.
Wow.
And I describe in the book this experience, and I get a piece of information I've never gotten before, have no idea where it came from, but I share with the father. He is so desperately clinging to his son and denying that his son is dying. And after days of his son hanging on, and I can't explain it, all the doctors at Children's Hospital can't explain it, I finally look at him, and I say the words, I've never said this to anyone before or since, but it's what came to me. I said to him, I think Ryan may be hanging on because he's concerned you're not going to be okay. Now, that, for me, it was early on in this journey. It was a huge stretch. I have no idea where that information came from.
Wow.
But I said to him, the most loving thing you can do is go in and tell your son, okay, if he dies, mm-hmm. you'll be okay. And he did that. And 2 hours later, Ryan died.
You know, when you tell me this, I can't tell you how many nurses I've talked to, even doctors, because I'm always curious about everything. I've been curious my whole life. And many of them have told me that it's almost like patients will wait till somebody leaves the room before they pass. It's almost like they don't want people, like they hold on. Like your story reminds me of that, that they will many times wait till someone is gone. Or somebody, they'll say, well, why don't you go get me? I'm fine. Why don't you go get something at the store? And then they'll choose to pass while that person is gone. Have you noticed that at all?
I've had experiences like that. I've known of experiences like that. And if I'm a skeptic, I go, yeah, and there are times people die in front of others. So it's like, how do we make meaning of that if I'm a scientist? Mm. And I share my thoughts in the book after this experience. This is 2-hour gap between him going in and telling his son, it's okay for you to go, and then he dies. Was that coincidence? Was that a data point? Could I even form the thought that a 6-month-old infant could have a consciousness that could make such a choice?
Mm-hmm.
So if I'm a serious scientist, I scratch my head at that. I stand in awe of the possibility. I also don't say I know for sure. It's as we have a series of these experiences, and over time we start to make meaning of them. And now we start to say, well, could there be a science related to this? How would we know? How would we study questions about reincarnation or consciousness? And can we study them? And I think that's where the new science is going, if we can let it go there. And one of the reasons I wrote the book, although it's written for a lay audience and it's very engaging, it's also written to help move forward the dialogue about the coming new paradigm and to bring closer the day when that is our paradigm, because science and spirituality are now really mutually reinforcing each other.
Now, do you think there's a reason why we're coming into this new paradigm now? Is it just because we've shifted our thoughts, or is there just a big change going on all around us?
I'll start with, I don't know. That's a good skeptical answer.
Okay.
And, I will then say, I am cautiously optimistic because, if you watch the news today, what makes the news? Violent, suffering, pain, loss. Why? Because it sells. Does that mean the world's going to hell in a handbasket? And while there are major challenges in our own society and throughout the world, as I've traveled the world, and I've been to Oneness University in India, to John of God in Brazil, I've been to Medjugorje, where there's been visions of Mary for 30 years plus, and the book is filled with stories from all these places, I have found people from all around the world that are on the same kind of path, that are hungry for something more in this life, that experience, as you have, there is something more. And trying to walk that path with courage and with openness for all that we can learn and grow and develop, and I would add, serve on that path.
Mm-hmm.
That's what we're here to do. And what I'm finding is all throughout the world, more and more people are awakening to that.
I agree with you.
There's a shift happening around the planet. And there are those who are still in negativity and violence and all of that, but it's also a growing number who are sharing this kind of awakening. And that's one of the reasons I very self-consciously chose the word awakening in the subtitle, because we're all awakening, and it's available to all of us. And I hope the book helps anyone who reads it on their path to awakening.
Have you ever looked at any of the Mayan teachings and the supposedly the 2012 shift? And because what you're talking about is very similar to many things that, I know worldwide. I've talked to people from different parts of the world, and I just see it. You can just feel it and see it, that people are changing. But also, they were kind of predicting that, and many ancient cultures were predicting that this really wasn't the end, it was actually the beginning. And that's kind of the way I see that we're going into this different time.
And I would say, as a scientist and a skeptic, I'd say maybe. Because, you know, the prediction of 2012 and the end of the world came and went. Well, did we get the date wrong? And I've heard that as an explanation. No. Has our consciousness shifted? Or there are a lot of possible explanations. I think it's important to maintain integrity as a scientist and skepticism about any claims. And yet, at the same time, I am experiencing my personal experiences and what's happening in science and all these different fields and the people I encounter from around the world and the interest in reading about this information and studying it, both from books and online. I think it's really burgeoning, and I think we are in the relatively early stages of that further awakening that I really hope is happening around the planet, and I've written the book to make whatever contribution I can. I hope the book touches as many people as possible and helps them with this awakening, because we're all connected in that way, and when one person awakens, it helps all others awaken.
That is an interesting comment in itself. Why do you feel that when one person awakens? Could you care to go into that a little bit more?
Yeah, I talk about that in the book, because we think, you know, I am a person. I look at my body, and my body has a boundary. I think of my mind, and I think, well, this is my mind. And this is part of what I learned in Oneness University. Bhagwan, who is the founder of Oneness University and a beautiful teacher, had this wonderful story he would tell to his students, and I shared this in the book, where he started with his students when they were young, and he'd say, well, whose shirt are you wearing? Well, it's my shirt, teacher. Really? Well, where did you get it from? From my parents. Well, where did they get it from? They bought it in a store. Where did that come from? Well, it was made in a factory or by hand. Where did that come from? Well, the cotton thread and the sunlight and the earth. So whose shirt is it? Where did it come from? And then he takes them down that road. And then when they're older, he does the same thing with their mind and their thoughts. He says, whose thoughts are they? Where did they come from? You think they're your thoughts? Well, where did you get them from? Well, from my parents, my teachers, whatever, my genetics. And where did that come from? Where did that come from? And it begins to blur the boundary of where I end and the rest of the world begins. Now, when we think, you know, as a physicist, why should I think anything ends at my skin boundary? It's just a semipermeable membrane, any different than the difference between my liver and, you know, some other part of my body, or my skin versus what's next to it. We're all part of a biosphere. We're all part of the, you know, fundamental particles flying around, if that's the model that you hold, and I do. Then where do I end and something else begins? And that gets to, you know, the whole question of what is our mind and where does it come from? And if you're a scientific materialist, you say, well, it's an epiphenomenon resulting from biochemical reactions in the brain. You go, well, that's possible. But then you bump up against what's called the hard problem of consciousness. How do you go from biochemical phenomena in the brain, electrical and biochemical, to thought, consciousness, experience? As one philosopher writes about it, the taste of pineapple. And you go, well, don't know. And here's the act of faith that scientific materialists take, the leap of faith in their web of belief, is I don't know the answer to that, but I've seen enough other things that were thought to be woo-woo and spiritual and explainable only that way that we now know this is science for. And that's my faith that we'll figure that out for mind, for consciousness. That's part of their web of belief. And I get that. My experience is I think consciousness goes beyond an individual subjective consciousness, and is there's an individual experience of it, and there's a way of having sharing of consciousness. And that communication at a distance that Marcia had teaches me we don't end at the boundary of our skin, do we? Even in our consciousness. So now I got a data point. that the scientific materials can't explain away other than to call it coincidence. So I think there's a far more interesting science of consciousness coming as we explore this and study it carefully.
Yeah. You just have to wonder how many people have kept their mouths shut about these kind of things over the years because of ridicule or just people not being open. And now, like you say, maybe also this change in this paradigm is going to be people getting past fear to express their own experiences, because there's got to be billions. I mean, every person, I'm sure, has had them. How do you feel about that?
I agree with you. There's a wonderful story I heard about a neurosurgeon who's this absolutely brilliant neurosurgeon and had fabulous results. But he went into therapy because he got really unhappy. And he finally admitted that he had never told anyone that what would happen is he would examine a patient and be with them and then hold their head in his hand. But he would not operate until he got some kind of internal message signal. It lit up, something like that. And then he'd operate.
Wow.
He was, and he'd have fabulous results. And he was petrified to tell anyone in his field that that's what was going on for him. I think those days are beginning to shift. Here's my concern. The way paradigms work, there is a dominant paradigm. It's still scientific materialism. And that helps, the dominant paradigm helps decide what counts as data, what kind of studies will be funded, what kind of studies will help move your career forward, and which ones will hurt your career. And that, I think, is a very real dynamic I'm concerned about as researchers risk their careers to study this. And one of the people I write about this in the book, because he's such a wonderful pioneer, his name is Professor William Tiller, and he was the chairman of the material science department at Stanford. And he woke up one time, and he has his own version of that story, and realized that the world is far more complicated. There's a spiritual aspect to it, and he's a highly trained, brilliant experimental scientist. He needs to commit at least a portion of his life to working on that. That's his contribution. He continued to do very conventional work in material science and make great contributions, but he let go of his chairmanship. He was no longer on the national committees he was on, and his career suffered because of that choice. Mm-hmm. And I hats off to him because of the courage that he showed by making that choice and sticking to it. And I write about his work in the book. There's a chapter in the book entitled When Science Meets God, A Glimpse into the Coming New Paradigm. And I use his work as really the example of the kind of good science being done, creating data points that are just mind-blowing, calling for a new paradigm. And what happened was I had to limit the amount of science I put in the book because it's really a book for a lay audience, but I put an expanded chapter on my website for a free download, and so you can download that from richchefmd.com, and it's got a more expanded discussion of his scientific studies and my thoughts about them and how they point us in the direction of the coming new paradigm.
So science really is starting to get a grasp on exploring the God particle, or that there's something else out there, right?
Well, I wouldn't use the God particle for the Higgs boson, simply in the sense that it's a particle. We think we've now discovered it at the collider in Europe, and it allows us to solve certain problems. We've been predicting it, but it doesn't give us spirituality. Mm-hmm. It stays within the paradigm of scientific materialism, as I understand it, and I'm not an expert in particle physics. But we talk about it as the God particle because that's a sexy title, as opposed to, well, we have particles. What are the particles made of? Quarks. What are those made of? Beats me. Where did they come from? Well, who started the Big Bang? You're left with some really deep questions that are yet to be answered, and I think there's good science that needs to be done about this.
Well, now that you don't consider yourself an atheist anymore, correct?
Well, not only am I not an atheist, I had an experience I did not expect. And about 2 years ago, going on three now, I guess, I professed vows as a monk in the Spirit of Peace monastic community, which is an interfaith, international monastic community. And my primary commitment in that monastic order is to pray for the world 2 hours a day.
Wow.
Now, I write about that, and the chapter title in the book is Brother Rick? And the title is I Didn't See This One Coming.
Mom and Dad didn't see that one coming.
They did not. They think they really messed up now.
They're probably going to disown you. I'm thinking the will's going to be pretty small.
And I look at them and I say, you know, you're both going to die soon, and we openly talk about that. And I said, I think you're really going to be surprised when you open your eyes on the other side. And they look at me kind of funny. I said, I just don't want you to be too surprised. I want you to have been warned, okay? And, you know, one of the things I read about in the book, my second wife, who is still my wife and very much a partner on this journey we've been on, she had a near-death experience at the age of 9.
Wow.
And I write about that in the book. It is jaw-dropping. It is beautiful. And I am indebted to her for her experience of that, her sharing it, and then what it has meant for her journey in this life. And I think these near-death experiences are so important to think about as a scientist.
Mm.
This is where the scientific materialists say, oh, that's just the agonal chemical activity of the brain. Well, what's the evidence for that? I'm a skeptic. When we have such consistency and then content. And so I think there's good science to be done about near-death experiences and a number of other things that I write about in the book that I've had experiences with.
I was reading online, and you don't know how accurate the website is or what proof they have, but there was an article that somebody had written about atheists who had near-death experience. They talked about Hindus, when they had a near-death, they might experience some of the Hindu gods. The Buddhists might see Buddha. The Christians might see Jesus, or maybe not, and some of the religious figures or angels. And then the atheists who had near-death experience, and this article claimed, and I'm sure there's been many different types of research done, none of those beings had a place that they went to that was hell, mainly because they didn't believe in it. I don't know. But every one of those beings experienced going to a place and seeing, experiencing something they felt was of a greater intelligence that was behind all of it. And many of those people that came back, some fairly well-known atheists, I guess, came back and changed their mind on how they saw things. Have you read anything like that or studied any of that?
I can't say I've studied the differences in near-death experiences based on someone's prior religious beliefs or atheist beliefs. I have had a number of people I've talked to about this whose lives have been changed by their near-death experiences, and there's more and more research about it. And this is where, again, if we put these together as data, here's what we're trying to figure out. How do we explain the data? That's what science is about. And we have data, and we have theories. And a good scientist knows that two things. One, that all theory, the technical way of saying it, all theory is underdetermined by data. That is, we can make up lots of theories that may or may not be true that could all be consistent with the data. And, you know, the example I could give you on an absurd level is to say, well, the moon is made of green cheese. And you'd say, well, but our astronauts have been to the moon and they've collected rocks that are not of green cheese. Well, that's because the moon changed to rock when they were there, and then when they left, it changed back to green cheese. And you go, okay, that's not a very good scientific theory, okay? And there are people who make spiritual arguments that sound like that, and you go, that's not a good theory. But at the same time, there are people who make scientific materialist arguments that sound like that to explain away data. So we have to tap into, and this is the second piece I want to share about this, is when theory and data don't agree, the data wins. Mm-hmm. And that's where I think good scientists need to go with high integrity, is to follow the data in pursuit of truth rather than be wedded to their current theories.
Right. Open up, I guess. Become more open to the possibility of all things. And I guess not having a scientific mind like yours, I've always been open to all possibilities. And not that I'm maybe a little bit gullible, you could say, too, Dr. Schaff, but I was willing to look at anything because I thought, how else will I learn? And it's led me down a road where it seems like the more I opened up to these things, the more I experienced those things. It's almost like I opened a doorway that allowed, if you want, psychic ability, if you want to call it that, when you start tapping into that, it becomes more. Have you ever experienced that? It's like some people will say that it's almost like a muscle, that the more you start using this ability, like your first wife, when she connected with her friend so closely who was pregnant. Some people, women seem to be more gifted at this because they're open to that, is my conclusion. And I know it's not scientific. And men, if they open their hearts to it and maybe get in touch with that side of themselves that's a little more sensitive, can feel these things as well. Have you done any, and just what's your personal thought on that?
Well, certainly my personal thought, I write about it in the book, because I had met people who said, oh, I'm an energy worker. I'm like, right, rolled my eyes, no, energy worker. That's too woo-woo for me. And then I had an experience that I write about in the book, and I'm meeting with a group of healers, and we're sort of learning from each other, and someone's trying to teach how to do some energy work, and I'm going, right, right, you know, hold your hands about, you know, 18 inches over this woman, and see what you feel, and I don't feel anything, I don't feel anything, and suddenly I bump into energy. I had never encountered it, never experienced it, but there was something pushing against my hands 18 inches off of this woman's body, and I could push it down, and I could pull it up, it had an elasticity. I was stunned, and I've since had many other experiences of feeling energy like that. But until you've had it the first time, it's like you got five senses and you say, if I can't see, feel, taste, etc., then it doesn't exist. Well, what if somebody's colorblind? They say, well, then color doesn't exist. Mm-hmm. Or they're colorblind. Therefore, light doesn't, you know, sight doesn't exist. And somebody else says, no, I see fine. And I had this experience. Now, here's something, and I didn't quite spell it out this way, but here's what happened. Sometime relatively shortly before that experience, I had my heart broken.
Wow.
Marriage broke up. My first wife fell in love with somebody else, and my heart was shattered. And it was after that experience, and now my engaging that, and I actually started to practice yoga as a way of being with this, because it was such an intolerable experience, that it was only after that that I felt energy. So I think it is about our journey. It is about our opening. It is about, you know, I've got a series of YouTube videos about this kind of content, and everyone wants to look at them. And one of them is entitled, What Will You Do With the Pain? Because we all experience pain from, in my case, the breakup of a marriage, the love of my life, the you know, losing that. Many people have had that experience. I have the experience of you know, someone's illness or death and financial challenges, and it causes pain. And the question is, what will you do with the pain in your life? Will you shut down? Will you close down your heart, or will you allow this to help you transform? And I think pain is so much our teacher, and we are able, if we use the pain to open, recognizing the heart grows by breaking, we deepen our experience of our own lives, and we open ourselves to these experiences that the best word we have for it is more and more spiritual.
you could almost, I mean, from I guess from my perspective, you could actually say that those moments are really blessings. And I think, from my perspective again, that they're divinely orchestrated to allow us to grow when those things happen. How do you feel about that?
I think, and I write about this in the book, because soon after this happens, I have somebody look at me, after the breakup of my marriage, I have somebody look at me and say, you know, you, Marcia, and this other person, this is how they said it, got together before this life and decided to do the dance this way. Now, I was definitely not there. I was feeling wrong. I was feeling angry. And I write about this in the book. And I say, no way, I fill in the blank, justify anger, etc. But then the journey I went on coming out of that and where I got to 2, 3, 4, 5 years later, my heart is open. My life is transformed. I have a new purpose in my life. And I'm going, you know, I could see the wisdom of having that choice. Now, I don't know if that actually happened. You know, Carolyn Mace writes about social soul contracts, and many others have, that we make these commitments before this life, at what we'll do together. And I go, okay, well, that's an interesting way to explain this. I don't know it to be the truth, but I hold it might be possible. And I've had my personal experience where I go, I could see the wisdom of making that choice, even though it hurts so much.
You do not sound like a conventional scientist when you talk that way, Rick.
Yeah, I know, and that's why, and I'm still a scientist, and I'm still a skeptic.
Well, I'm just, it's cool that you can take that on because you've had this and see the potential that it could be, because so many people I know, myself included, have had those kind of things. And having that ability to look at it from that perspective, for me, allows me to let go, first and foremost, to know that this is part of a bigger design. And I really, if I'm totally in control of my own universe, who do I have to blame? Nobody, really.
Well, now that's one I'm, you know, and I understand the law of attraction and the secret and that whole approach. And I understand there are people who think that really is the way it works, that I am the complete author of everything that happens in my life. And as a scientist, as well as a pilgrim on the spiritual path, I think there's some truth to that. My current level of belief says I think there's some truth to that. But I also find you're at risk of blaming the victim with that perspective. That says for everyone who comes down with a major illness. So now you're blaming me for my cancer, or my car accident, or fill in the blank, and you'd go, to me that's not as loving a perspective as to say, this is really complicated. If we try and ask the question, why are you having this experience in your life now? And I think there are layers and layers of richness to answering that question. And the law of attraction and we author our own lives are just two of those layers. I think there are many others that are at play here that we don't really understand.
Well, you know, I guess the way I'd look at it, Dr. Sheff, is that I would say, let's say somebody commits an atrocity and everybody hates that person. And I just would look at it and say, I don't know what their path was before they came here, so I do not want to judge that. And the same with somebody that develops a disease. They may have brought it on themselves, which I think a lot of disease is brought on. I think there's solid evidence to support that. Or there may be other circumstances. If you're exposed to certain things in your workplace, there could be many answers. It's not always just one. I don't quite see it as just always being one, but I think a lot of what we do is what we, if we focus on certain things, we tend to bring them forward, it seems like. That's been my experience over and over again. What is your feeling on God? Can you describe, or divine spirit, or whatever label you want to give it?
Well, the way I would answer that is and I talk about this in the chapter on When Science Meets God, that I think science can get us to spirituality, but when I both think about and then experience God, and I'll talk about that in a minute, where what can be languaged as God, I think we've left the realm of science there. Because science is the wonderful dialectic or dance between logic and data, logic and measurement, back and forth. And there's intuition and there's, you know, aha moments and creativity, but ultimately, in its most disciplined way, it's logic and data. And that's a very valuable way to pursue truth. But I think there are truths that go beyond that. And I write about this in the science chapter that says, knowing something scientifically, even the process of doing science, is not our highest form of consciousness. And we mistake it if we do. And if we allow science alone without something else to guide us, we end up with all kinds of bad things. More and more weapons of mass destruction and all that. We have other ways of being conscious. Love, compassion, forgiveness, and an awareness that is beyond the logic that we're talking about in science. And that's where I would answer your question, and I write about this in the book, that I have had direct experiences of something that I can now language. And I write in the book, I had trouble with the G word. I couldn't even say it for decades and decades of life. It was so not a part of my upbringing or who I was. And to find my way past that to now being very much comfortable, and we language this in whatever way you want, the ultimate, the divine, spirit, God, any way that you language what this is, I have had direct experiences of it. And the term I like to use for that is gnosis. That the Gnostics were a group, and I don't use that in a sectarian sense, but in the sense of direct knowledge of this divinity, because they've experienced it. And I have had those experiences. I write about some of them in the book. They are transformational. As you said, they are joy-filled and awesome, in the true sense of awe. And that's something that's how I hold whatever that is, that we use the word God. And just think about this. We are talking about a level of consciousness, human consciousness, and language that tends to be pretty linear, to try and talk about things that are beyond what can be expressed in language, mm-hmm. and beyond what our particular form of human consciousness is capable of fully grasping. And I have a certain humility about that that I think is important for anyone who encounters these types of experiences.
I agree. Humility. You cannot put it into words. The closest I can come to it is this incredible bliss feeling. A pure joy. And then what is that? Pure joy, pure, you know, I experienced it from both my parents. I've experienced it. I live out in the country, and I've sat there and been in such a peaceful state. And you get this feeling of, what is love? I mean, how do you describe that? How can you find that? We think love is between a father and his children, or between a loved one, a spouse. But this love that I felt goes way beyond that. It pales. Yeah. The love that we think we have for one another pales in comparison. And this is just an overwhelming feeling that just envelops you. It goes right through you. I don't know how to describe it.
I'm smiling from ear to ear because I have experienced that. And I honor that you've experienced that. And this is my hope for your listeners, that they, on their path, open to and have the opportunity to experience that as well.
Well, if you're interested, it's
being,
go ahead. If you have something else you want to add, go ahead, Rick.
I was going to say that's being joyfully shattered.
Joyfully shattered. I must be reading your mind. Joyfully shattered. A physician's awakening at the crossroads of science and spirituality. Get his book, and also your website is Rick Schaff. Rick Schaff at rickschaffmd.com, right?
Right. And There's a free download of a number of things, including a guided meditation. You can get my book there. It's available in hard copy, in e-book, and now in audio book with me reading it. It's also available at Amazon and Barnes & Noble. And the YouTube videos and the blog are all there because I'm trying to help everyone on their own path.
Well, thank you very much for joining me today.
Thank you very much for the opportunity.